Right, we're going to end off our Covenant Applied series tonight with looking at a very important topic, the topic of gun control and how it relates to us as a people, as believers, and how we are to think of this topic. Now, the covenant lays out God's hierarchy and what is expected of his subjects. Okay, it lays it out for us. Who's in charge, what the structures are, what the order is, what your responsibilities are. Authority is granted along with responsibilities, sanctions, and also the hope of success. So that's what we get in the covenant. We've got this package deal that explains all these details to us. Now, life and property are fundamental to the outworking of God's kingdom plans in this world. When God judged man's rebellion in the days of Noah, he destroyed both life and property. That was part of his judgment, came upon both life and property. The covenant God made with Abraham had property at the core. He said, I have a land for you and I will give it to you. This is going to be promised to you. The land of Israel served as a microcosm of God's ultimate goal, which is for his people to serve him in the whole earth. Okay, so they were a microcosm of what God was intending the whole structure to be like. Life and property remain central to the outworking of God's plan. You shall not murder and you shall not steal are central to God's dominion plans, because it is through his servants living long on the earth and using their property for his glory that his kingdom advances. It doesn't advance without these things. We live, however, in a fallen world that hates God and is at war with him, is at war with his ways of the way he does things. And those who hate God love death. Thus we see that throughout Scripture, there is this presumed responsibility to protect life and property, and the way the kingdom of darkness assaults God's kingdom is by destroying both life and property. You've got your mindset in the world. If you have an uprising of rebellion against some policy that somebody doesn't like, or the student rebellions which have happened through the 60s and 70s and stuff, they would destroy property. That was the kind of goal or object that they would zero in their attack upon. Central to the purpose of the covenant man, is his responsibility to defend his life and his property. Okay, it's fundamental, because if those things are jeopardized, there is no advancing the kingdom. Remember when Lot was captured by a number of kings and much property was looted in Genesis 14, that Abraham responded immediately with 318 trained servants. And he attacked those kings that had banded together to go and plunder Lot's kingdom, so to speak, with the kings, and that they were joined together. And he responded immediately, attacked them and defeated them and brought back the possessions. You read about that in Genesis 14, 15 and 16, freeing the people and their possessions. Abraham was armed and prepared to defend his household, and he exemplifies for us what it means to be a covenant man leading a household. It was after this battle that Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek, the priest and the king of Salem. And Abraham gave to Melchizedek at that time a tithe, a tenth of all the spoils that he had brought back from battle, and Melchizedek blessed him. And this wasn't a mystical thing, because Melchizedek's... Let me try that again. Melchizedek. That guy. He blessed him, but it wasn't a mystical thing, but very down to earth. Abraham was doing God's will in a fallen world, and what that meant was being in a position to defend what he had that God had blessed him with in order to serve the Lord, to protect life and property. These were important details in his understanding of how the Lord's will is accomplished. Okay, we know that the children of Israel were armed in the wilderness. They were equipped with their weapons. When you had the incident, the rebellion in Exodus 32 around there, when Moses instructed him, he said, take your sword, strap it to your side, and let's go and deal with these rebellious people. It was a presumed thing, and they were engaged in battles as well with God's enemies. King Jehoshaphat of Judah was a godly man, and he saw great peace during his reign. However, the nation's preparedness must not be overlooked as contributing to this peace. His nation was prepared for doing battle and for standing. And this preparedness was one of the blessings that God bestowed upon them, and which in turn brought the fear of the Lord upon the hearts of their potential enemies, as we read in 2 Chronicles 17. So he had a well-prepared army, he had a standing force, but he also had an incredibly well-prepared and led militia. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of armed militia that protected the cities. And so this kind of turned the hearts of the enemies to look upon them with favor, because they were well armed, hundreds of thousands of men. In Jehoshaphat's mind, he wasn't thinking, you know, I feel very threatened if we have hundreds of thousands of men in my cities with weapons. He didn't try and disarm them. Wanting to disarm people in scripture and in history is always tied to tyranny and oppression. The tyrant's goal is to subjugate a people so that he can use them for his own ends. He wants their property for himself ultimately. He wants to use their property, he wants to use them, he wants to use their labor, he wants to use their resources for his own agenda and his own ends. And so tyrants have always turned their attention to disarming a people so that they can be manipulated by him. So he wants to disarm them to do that. In the time of Saul, the Philistines wouldn't allow any blacksmiths to be in Israel so that they weren't allowed to make weapons. They couldn't make weapons. And you can read about that in 1 Samuel 13. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had swords. The rest of the army of Israel had no swords. They were disarmed and they couldn't get swords, they couldn't make swords, because any ironwork that needed to be done on some farm implement had to be taken across to the Philistines' blacksmiths, and they would do the work for them, and so they could control any production of weaponry. And that's oppression. The Philistines were oppressing Israel. They were oppressing Israel because of the rebellion of Saul, by the way, but still, that's a sign and an emblem of what oppression looks like. And another example showing that being disarmed is a sign of oppression is found in Judges, where we learn that there was no sword or shield in Israel, Judges 5 verse 8. God in His grace can and does deliver His people from oppression. However, this must not make us think that being disarmed is the norm. It is a sign of God's judgment, not blessing, and God can deliver you out of that, but that position is not a sign of His blessing. Jesus exhorted His disciples very strongly to get swords. He said, "But now, he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack. And he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." Okay, that's the importance he's putting on. Sell your garment, rather. Rather go without a garment than without a sword. Luke 22, 36. Now, a little later on, when Peter draws his sword and cuts off the servant's ear, when Jesus is being arrested, Jesus doesn't tell him, "Hey, let's get rid of your sword." He just says, "Put it away. This is not the context to use your sword." Okay, so we mustn't get blurred about what is going on there. So throughout the scripture, we see that there's a presumption of living in a fallen world and what that entails and how one goes about protecting property and protecting self from both thieves, external enemies, as well as the internal enemy of the state itself, the state that wants to rise up as an oppressor. While Hitler was secretly building up his arsenal, unknown to the rest of the world, doing that secretly, he was at the same time disarming his population. He didn't want them to have guns. That was part of his strategy. He knew that in order for me to accomplish my goals, my agenda, I have to disarm these people, otherwise they become a threat to me. So, because they're not going to like what I'm going to do, and so I need to disarm them. Central to Marxism is a disarmed populace, which is the path to confiscating all property. Because if you cannot defend yourself, then you cannot defend your property. And if I want your property, then I've got to get rid of anything that you might be able to use that can hinder me from accomplishing my goals. Now, the founding fathers of America understood the inseparable ties between liberty, property, and being armed. There was no confusion in their minds about that at all. We know the Declaration of Independence, but there was a document that preceded that by a year that was called the Declaration of the Causes and the Necessity of Taking Up Arms. So on July the 6th, 1775, the Second Constitutional Congress met and they came up with this document declaring their intent now to engage in war with England. But one of the things that they mentioned as indicating that God was with them in the struggle was because, and I quote, "they possessed the means of defending themselves." This was a sign of God's providence upon us. We now have the means to do this. And that means they had the weaponry to do that. They interpreted their armaments as a sign of divine favor toward them. They used that term. This is a sign of divine favor toward us, that we're in a position to defend ourselves and stand against you. At that stage, they didn't want to break from England. When they made that declaration, they said, "This is not to break from England. We don't want to separate from you. We just want to stand against the tyranny that's coming upon us." But then a year later, by the time the declaration came, they said, "Well, enough's enough. Now we're going to break." After the war, the Constitution was drawn up, to which the amendments were later added. There is debate in some circles about the exact meaning of the Second Amendment. It is argued that the words don't necessarily lead to the view that the individual's rights to own a weapon were intended. People will argue that point. They'll say, well, no, it's not the individual here that's intended, because the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. So they kind of say it's a bit confusing. Maybe it's a well-regulated militia, and we'll regulate the militia, you see, so it's still under this control. Now, you say, okay, well, possibly those words are like that. But if you go back to the debates that were happening at the time of drafting the Constitution and the amendments, then any confusion and doubt is absolutely removed. Because when looks up at the debates leading up to the ratification, because you had the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists debating at that stage, the guys who wanted the federal government and the Constitution and guys who were opposed to that and said, this sounds like tyranny to me, that's where it's going to end up. And so they had massive debates. And one of the real concerns of the Anti-Federalists who were opposed to the Constitution ratifying that was the standing army, and saying, look here, this we fear a standing army, because a standing army can lead to tyranny and oppression of the people. So that's our big fear. And Patrick Henry, by the way, from his great speech, which got the War of Independence beginning, he was an Anti-Federalist, by the way, and he was opposed to the ratifying of the Constitution. And it's interesting studying to look into his ideas as to what he was afraid of. But here, at the time of the Constitution, you have Noah Webster, who I believe he sided with the Federalists. I could be wrong. Maybe somebody can correct me on that. But I think he was on the Federalist side. But he assured those who feared a standing army that they had nothing to fear because the people were armed. He said, you've got nothing to fear about a standing army because the people are armed. In a newspaper article published in October of 1787, he said, and I quote, another source of power in government is a military force. Okay, so he's talking about a standing army here. But this, to be efficient, must be superior to any force that exists among the people, or which they can command. For otherwise, this force would be annihilated on the first exercise of act or oppression. Before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, and they are as they are in almost every kingdom in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword, because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops that can be on any pretense raised in the United States. A military force at the command of Congress can execute no laws but such as the people perceive to be just and constitutional, for they will possess the power to resist the execution of the law which appears to them unjust and oppressive. Because the people are all armed, they can resist anything that tries to be forced upon them by a standing army. Okay, so this knows Webster's position, okay? And so he's supporting the Constitution. And he wrote this on the 17th of September, 1787. So it's clear from this that armed citizens are a fundamental check upon a tyrannical federal government in the minds of all Americans. In the Federalist Paper number 46, written by James Madison, so this is somebody who wanted the Constitution to come into force and be ratified, he said, the military establishments in the several kingdoms of Europe, the governments are afraid to trust the people with arms. Let us not insult the free and gallant citizens of America with the suspicion that they would be less able to defend the rights of what they would be in actual possession of. So he's saying, this is not what we're going to do. There's no ways we're going to take people's guns away, because it would undermine the liberty of the people. After the ratification of the Constitution, there were still many concerns in the states, and so they had the opportunity to express these, which led to the adoption of the Bill of Rights. Okay, that came later. The Bill of Rights is really the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and these were put in place, but the states debated this and came up with wording as to, okay, what should be included in this. And this shows what the people were concerned about. The Pennsylvania Convention, in December of 1787, wrote, the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and their own state, or the United States, or for the purpose of killing game, and no law shall be passed for disarming the people or any of them unless for crimes committed or real danger of public injury from individuals. Okay, so nobody can be disarmed unless they've committed a serious crime. The resolutions of the state of New York in 1788 said that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia, including the body of the people capable of bearing arms, is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. How do you maintain a free state other than having a people that are able to keep those in power in check? South Carolina stated in 1788 that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. North Carolina agreed with that same statement. So you've got all these states coming up and saying, this is what we understand, these are our concerns, and there's the Second Amendment is put into place. What is its meaning? How do we interpret it? There's only one interpretation of that statement. So the Second Amendment cannot be saying something different from the concerns that the states had emphasized, namely that the individual had the right to bear arms and that it was the best check upon tyranny and oppression from both external and internal enemies. So there's nothing confusing or vague about that in its historical context, the Second Amendment. It is tyrants who seek to suppress its meaning because the only way they can achieve their objective is to disarm the population. Biblically and constitutionally, we have a right to own weapons, and any gun ban is a flagrant violation of these God-given rights, liberties, and responsibilities. Now, coming back to kind of modern times, we can go through some statistics and stuff. But Connecticut, where the massacre just happened, they abolished the death penalty in 2012, 8 months before the Newtown School massacre of 20 children and 6 adults. Death penalty is gone. Now, I didn't hear of any major news media saying that there's any kind of connection, or should we even consider, is there any connection? Now, I'm not aware that that person who did the massacre intended at the beginning that he was going to kill himself. There seems to be evidence that he wasn't intending to do that. I don't know. We don't know those questions. But to say that the removing the death penalty has no bearing on what goes through somebody's mind before they commit something like that would be very ignorant indeed. Only 9 states carried out death sentences in 2012. You see, we talk about gun banning, and we talk about at the same time removing a death penalty for murder that people are using weapons to do. So 9 states in 2012 carried out death sentences. 16 states have officially abolished the death penalty. Colorado, Maryland, and New Hampshire are going to try and abolish it in their next state legislative session. Others that haven't yet abolished it don't want to use it. For example, in California, they have 724 inmates on death row, yet they haven't carried out an execution in 7 years. And in a referendum at this past election they just had, 52% of the population said, we want the death penalty. And those who enforce it said, no, we're not doing it. They're just dragging their feet. They're not prepared to do it. So the vote, we shout about democracy and people say democracy, but it really doesn't. It doesn't mean much when you've got an agenda that people want to fulfill. When 20 children are brutally killed, the call to ban guns is immediately heard. But this doesn't rest on any hard statistics of saying this is a statistic that shows how dangerous guns are, and that gun control reduces murder, because that's what the statistic that they're hoping to try and prove. The Brady Campaign, which is an organization that is working to ban guns, and they have all this stuff up on the web. You can find it on the webpage, Brady Campaign. In their fight against guns, they published the statistics about states showing that the states with stricter gun laws have fewer gun owners. Okay, so where you have the very strict gun laws, you have 14% of the population owning guns. Where the gun laws are not so strict in some states, you have 53% of the people owning guns. However, the states that have the strictest gun laws and fewest gun owners have double the amount of gun-related deaths than the free states where the laws are not so strict. So there's a double amount of deaths. So the statistics don't back up. Get rid of the guns, we get rid of the problem. This is the solution to somebody using a gun in an unlawful way. Australia and the UK both enacted sweeping gun control laws. However, their violent crime rates have continued to increase. UK women are raped twice as much as US women. Australian women are raped 3 times as many as US women. Between 1998 and 2007, the murder rate increased by 14% in England and Wales. 14%. They've incredibly strict gun laws. And the murder rate continues to go up. The murder by firearm increased by 28%. And the murder by kicking and punching increased by 57%. Because somebody can... A soldier had a friend in South Africa who was walking from the gym to his car, and he had his firearm in his pocket of his jacket, and he was attacked. It was nighttime, and the guy hit him on the head, and he was groggy, and he fell to the ground, but he pulled out his gun, and the guy turned and ran. So, you're not going to get punched and kicked to death if you've got a firearm on you. But yeah, you've got that, people know there's no arm, there's no chance that this person's going to pull a weapon on me. The UK and Australia gun bans now, after 10 years of experimentation, they have not reduced. They had not had the effect they said to their population this was going to be the effect. The media gets extremely emotional about mass shootings, yet remains supportive of killing over 900 babies every day. You see 27-year-olds being brutally mowed down, and there's an absolute outcry. And rightly so. And rightly so. But there's over 900 babies every single day. Every 76 seconds, that's what it works out to, there's a baby being brutally murdered in the United States. The same mindset that wants to take away people's guns sees nothing wrong with murdering of the most defenseless in our society. And they do this for nothing more than their own personal convenience. It's my agenda. This is inconvenient. I'm not going to be able to fit this into my schedule. So let's get rid of this inconvenience. And these are the people that are saying to you, give me your gun and I'll protect you. The 1994, if you remember the Rwanda genocide, where the Hutus rose up against the Tutsis, the two different tribes. But the Hutus had enforced rigorous gun control upon the Tutsis before they did that. And then they were able to kill 500,000 Tutsis in a matter of 6 weeks. And most of those deaths with machetes. When the Turks massacred 1.5 million Armenians, this is not Armenians, this was in between 1915 and 1917, and I believe Rushdie's family escaped from that with him. They fled from that massacre. When they did that, prior to that, the Turks had imposed upon the Armenians very rigorous gun controls as well. We could keep going. I could probably bore you to tears with the historical accounts of that pattern and what that mindset produces. One of the fundamental things that a covenant leader is to do is to provide for his family's protection. That is a vital thing and a vital responsibility, I believe, that God gives us, to protect life and property in our family. A covenant head has to regard as a primary responsibility the protection of his family, and fundamental to this protection is the protection of his own life. Okay, there are some people out there saying that self-defense is not something that we should engage in. That is just madness. If you cannot protect yourself, then you have no way of protecting your family. Now, you can't protect yourself by denying the Lord. Okay, you don't save your life in order to do that, in order to save my family. I deny the Lord. That's a line we can't go through, but we are responsible to protect ourselves. So how do we respond to a gun control threat? Well, prayer and repentance is the starting place. It'd be a good idea to have a weapon, and to strenuously resist the attempt through all the legal means and appeals processes that we have available to us. But if it fails and the controls come into existence, then there's a number of things that need to be considered as to try and determine what God expects you to do. Obviously, a big issue has to do with the new laws, what they actually say, what they're actually going to do. And then so it's hard to speculate until you know, okay, this is what's happened, this is what's on the table. Now, how do you respond to this? Are they removing all guns? Are they removing every gun in the country? Are they just going to control the making of new guns? So how do you respond to that? It would need wisdom. Gun control is an assault upon liberty, and depending upon how encroaching the laws are, we have to determine where the line is. What is the non-negotiable? Where do we draw that line? And that, once again, it's not just a simple answer, because a lot of other dynamics come into making that decision. You know, could the next Congress reverse what this Congress has put in? You know, there's always that hope and possibility. And even with the leading up to the War of Independence, there was tremendous amount of imploring and beseeching and writing to the King and the Parliament in England and saying, brethren, these are our grievances. This is the truth. Can we not work this out? And so we mustn't be too quick to want to run towards a final stand. But vital to a stand, in my mind, if it came to that, would be to, there needs to be recognized leadership that could guide and help bring people together and organize. If you're going to make a stand, there needs to be that. That's a vital ingredient to any kind of stand that is ever made. Now, sometimes a lone stand could spark something, but there's no guarantees of that. In Zimbabwe, you had Martin Olds, a farmer who decided to stand and defend his farm. And he sent his family away, and he stayed back. He had a shotgun and a hunting rifle. very limited ammunition. And 200 plus AK-47 wielding thugs came and surrounded his farm. There was a security fence around the outside, so his house was there, and he was in his house, and he came out to speak to them. They were outside the gate, and they opened fire on him and hit him in the leg. It shattered his leg bone, and he crawled back inside and put a splint on his own leg, and then continued to fight and hold them all for 3 hours until he ran out of ammunition, and he killed some. And then the only way they could get him out was set fire to his house, and eventually he had to get out the house, and they grabbed him and beat him to death because he was unarmed. But he decided to make a stand, and you can sometimes make a lone stand and say, Lord, I believe this is conviction from you, and that's an individual decision as to stand against something that's an impossible odds. Lots needs to be thought through on those issues. Now, to protect your own property is not the same as trying to overthrow a tyrant. Okay, you can't decide to overthrow a tyrant on your own. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the Second World War, he was involved in an attempted assassination plot against Adolf Hitler, and I believe it was a just and a righteous stand that he was involved in. And the reason it was just and righteous was because there was a whole mechanism of leadership that was going to come into place as Hitler was disposed of. They were going to move in and take over the reins of the German government and reverse the whole situation. But they were recognized leaders by the people, and they were ready to move. And a lot of these people were actually exposed themselves and were executed afterwards because of the failed attempt on Hitler's life. They didn't know it had failed on his life, and so they had to start moving to assume positions and reins of authority before things were left too late. And then they found out he was alive, and it reversed back on them. But they were ready to move into place, and that was legitimate. Okay, so there is a legitimate place for resisting, but it has to have those legitimate leaderships. Defending your own property is not on that same level, and you need to use wisdom and understanding, and with all the different factors you need to weigh up in order to know what is the way to stand in a biblical sense. That leadership, I believe, is the biblical explanation of how, when you've got an ultimate tyrant up here, how you resist him. And that's with the lesser magistrates, lesser recognized leaders. You see, that is a scriptural and biblical principle. And there is a place to resist leadership. If you doubt that, you just have to think about David resisted King Saul when he ran away from him. That was resisting. Saul said, come here. He said, not on your nilly. He was resisting him. And so you've got resisting of leadership of tyrants, and then you've got the whole judges. You've got some good accounts there that will give insight into the legitimacy of that. But leadership is fundamental to any life-threatening resistance, which means that if there's no recognized legitimate leadership, this will go a long way in helping to decide what you ought to do at any given point. Then our way of resisting would be different. If there's no leadership, your way of resisting is different. Okay, now it takes in a whole new dynamic as to what do we do, how do we do this. If states differ in the kinds of laws that are instituted, maybe you need to think about moving. Lots of decisions come in as to how do I fulfill my responsibilities before God and resist this. Fundamentally, it is reformation that is needed. People coming to faith and living by every word from God's mouth. And despite dark situations, God is sovereign, and He is working out His details according to His purposes of ultimate victory. And thus we need to be reading the signs, understanding the signs, understanding the circumstances, understanding Scripture, what it says on these things. This is an important topic, and we need to be thinking covenantally about it, because gun control makes our families more vulnerable to both internal and external enemies. It's fascinating when you study Hitler's movements in World War II, and how he constantly just kept skirting Switzerland. Just wouldn't touch Switzerland. Refused. Because he knew the ratio of how many Germans would be needed per Swiss person was huge. Because every Swiss man was armed. Fully armed. And he knew that this would just be impossible to take Switzerland. So despite the strategic advantage that Switzerland would have been, he refused to enter Switzerland. He just skirted around it. Crushed everybody else. But refused to take this little pimple of a state. Because of that fact, that was a fundamental thing. Okay, the terrain was also negative, but the fact that every family was armed was a high negative against him. That's why it was very interesting when the people were shouting the loudest here straight after the school massacre for gun control, that you heard the national press in China also calling for it, saying to America, yeah, you need to institute gun control on your people. to me, it's kind of, yeah, I'm sure that their desire is just humanitarian, wasn't it? So it's an important topic to think through. I've kind of skimmed over it. There's a lot of stuff. I try to just touch on some of the aspects, briefly the biblical side as well as the historical side of this nation as to where we stand, so that at least we can know, okay, we can get rid of the Constitution. I mean, that's an option, but until we do that, that's what our nation is governed by, and we need to hold to that. And God's law, I believe, is in line with that. And so as we think through these issues, as we try and work out maybe these questions, discussions or additions that could be added on.